Hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9, coming at you here from the center of the universe, and that, of course, is Clear Creek County, Colorado, up in the loft of the United Center in the studios of the KYGT radio station here. And this is The Rabbit Hole, today, special edition of Writer's Talk. And in the studio with me is Janine Bolin, who is an author, scientist, shaman, and sacred clown. When Janine was younger, she was literally struck by lightning. It was an experience she obviously lived through, but is the identification of the sacred clown. Janine's goal in life was to be a scientist and live the contemplative life. All she ever wanted was to talk to God in a two-way conversation. Her form of God chasing expressed itself in working with a Hindu guru for over 20 years to achieve a state of enlightenment. During this training, Janine worked as an analytical biochemist, homeschooled four children, published four books on personal finance, and was married to her college sweetheart for 30 years. In 2010, Janine was called into active service by the Thunder Clan when she was initiated as a sacred clown, and pulled into her life's purpose. So, Janine, welcome.
It's wonderful to be here, especially since I'm at the center of the universe. I am thrilled to be here again.
Okay. And you know where I get that? The center of the universe line is actually Native American.
Quite right. It's the center of the medicine wheel, or wherever you are standing. Isn't
exactly.
It?
And the one who put that really into conversation or into thought too was Black Elk. If you've read Black Elk Speaks, which I'm sure you have.
Yeah, correct. It was the only way I could figure out what on earth was happening to me was to start reading some of that literature.
Well, this is fascinating. Because you have worked your books. Some of them are financial oriented, okay? The grocery store, money, and yet you have another series, Seeking the Divine, Finding the Divine. You have another in the work. And it seems that, there's like you got these two pathways going, and yet they're not separate in a way. So talk about you and how you came into this in some way. You said you were struck by lightning, but, there's more than that in life.
Correct. So one of the fun things I like to share with people is the fact that it looks like two separate pathways if you're looking at it in a marketing perspective, which is you only focus on one thing, you do it well, you rise to that area of life, and then you move on. You don't try to do two things at once. It's almost like you have to be single-pointed in everything. And I just wanted to share with you, in quantum mechanics, that's not the case. And so as an analytical biochemist, which is the study of the cell at the molecular level, we had to take a lot of quantum mechanics in our study of that. And it was just coming into being when I was going through college at the time. And one of the things I like to share with people is at the quantum level, all potentiality exists. And to limit ourselves to one thing or another, or one thing at a time, is actually teaching ourselves that we're limited, and we're not. We're unlimited. And so that's just a little bit of the podium I like to get up and preach from, so to speak, is that we are really limited by what other people have told us about ourselves. So I like to kind of demonstrate or lead by example of, look, I'm doing this, 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 and this, and four or five things at once, it appears, but I only focus on one thing at a time, complete it, then move on to the next thing. And so I can never really just do one thing at a time, but I can focus on only one thing at a time.
Right. And when I think of quantum, and we're going to do a 30-second synopsis of quantum mechanics, because many of our listeners may have heard the term, but it's very vague. It kind of get more the Einsteinian version of relativity in a way. That's difficult, but quantum goes just the opposite, right?
Quantum mechanics was often called fuzzy physics by people like Einstein. Please remember, Einstein never bought into what Niels Bohr and the others were doing at that time. Between Bohr and Heisenberg and Schrodinger, those people were just kind of kooky as far as Einstein was concerned, because it really didn't fit in with what he was aware of. But grateful, I'm very grateful we couldn't have moved into quantum if it hadn't been for Einstein. So we don't leave Einstein in the dust, because the man was onto something. It was just, please remember, he wasn't a mathematician. He really didn't enjoy math. He needed help with the math. And so remember also, Heisenberg and the others were mathematicians. And so taking Einstein's thoughts, as if you will, and taking them into the micro level, you started to see where things unravel, hence the rabbit hole. And then as you further you go down, it gets fuzzy only if you demand it to be in a linear fashion. So if you start talking about potential and probability, that is where quantum mechanics is strong, because then it says you can do anything. Anything is possible. Nothing is impossible. It's improbable, but it's not impossible. And that's what threw mathematicians for a loop for the longest time, because they could see all of the universe in all of its potentiality. And the only thing that limits that is our belief.
Yeah, and preconceived ideas. There was a film, a video done, you might have seen it, What the Bleep Do We Know?
Love that film.
Yeah, and it gets into that whole, a couple things. One is how we filter out the billions of bits of information that come into our mind, in our brain, because we're looking at it, primarily those that have sight, or we also hear it auditorily, whatever, but our senses pick it up. But we filter out the vast, vast majority of it and focus only on the one item there. And they used the metaphor of a camera that does not have any prejudice. It simply takes the picture of whatever's happening, you know, in front of it there. So it doesn't differentiate in any way. And so, I you know, in What the Bleep there, you know, and then the other is that how they used the experience of a woman who her husband, you know, cheated on her and everything, and how that shaped her life and in ways she was not even imagining, and how that traumatic event controlled. And yet we find that, you know, fairly often in our own experiences.
Definitely, the traumatic events will shape our reality. And a lot of times those traumatic events are there to show us we are more than what we are allowing ourselves to be. And so one of the things that is required of human beings is we are lulled into a state of security or sleep, if you will. And then we have, if you wish to say it this way, we have some event that occurs that seems to come out of left field. We almost feel like slapped in the face, and we attribute a lot of negative emotions to whatever that event is. But believe it or not, you know, that's actually you, your future self, seeing you headed down a path that is not right for you. And the only way to get your attention is to do something traumatic to you so that you will listen. You'll start to pay attention to the millions of details that you weren't aware of. Then you start to meet different people. Then you're moving into an area of reality that wasn't a part of your reality as far as you were concerned for a period of time. And this also goes back to quantum mechanics and the potentiality that you are no longer slicing off 90% of the potentiality that you are opening up to more of your potential, like Heisenberg recommended.
And my somewhat crude way of putting it is that sometimes the universe just needs to give you a good swift kick in the butt to get you to move on to other, and to open up your mind, your revelation, because through trauma, and I remember when I published my book and I did my first book launch, and a group of friends, 20 some people, and we're over there talking about it. And I was, you know, pretty honest about what provoked it, what brought it about. And then I thought in that moment, is that something I wish hadn't happened? And the answer is yes. Yet because of that, you and I are sitting here talking right now. If that hadn't happened, I would have never written a book, probably. I would probably have never launched into this, and we wouldn't be having this conversation here. So we just don't know, is it?
That's the beauty of it, though. If we always like to talk in physics about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and Schrodinger's cat. Those are the two big ones that really cause people to think, oh, well, now physics has just become philosophy. But no, the math is always right. And this is something that I would like to let people know, is that In physics, especially quantum mechanics, it's not philosophy. They've done the tests, and one of the first times they started doing these tests, no matter where in the world they were, no matter what scientific laboratory they were in, the test came out the same over and over and over. And that kind of consistency in science just doesn't happen. You just don't have that. But what they are saying is, over and over again, they're talking about potential and probability. These are the big ones. And if you've ever read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or any of Douglas Adams' other stuff, he likes to play with that in a science fiction sort of way. But he's right. It's like when you really open up to everything that you can be, it gets a little scary because that's what you're afraid of, is like, well, I don't know where this is going to take me. Hence Alice falling down the rabbit hole. And that's what's so delightful about it as well. If you're one of these crazy people like myself, where you don't care where you're headed, you just know it's going to be better than where you were. Yeah. You'll bucket yourself in and scream with your hands over your head and have a great time. But if you're trying to control the fall, if you're trying to control the descent, if you're trying to keep yourself safe, if you're trying to stay secure, these things will lead to your distress.
Right. And, you know, the another metaphor I use is that when we move into the realm of the unknown, we're on a new adventure, and we look at it as falling off a cliff. Well, the falling and the descent down is not, I mean, what is traumatic. It's the anticipation of the end result that probably will frighten someone, right? And then, but then move that metaphor from that to say, I'm floating in space, or I'm adrift on the ocean without an oar, without a motor or anything, and I'm simply going where the ocean takes me, and it is where it is. That starts to, once we move from that, I'm jumping off a cliff and going, oh no, to, you know, it's okay. I'm simply out here drifting. And that to me is, you know, liberating, if you will.
Those are wonderful metaphors. And of course, I start laughing when you start talking that way, just because as a scientist, I would say, no, the fall is never the problem. It's the sudden stop that causes most people to have a panic. The thing is that if you're going to talk about metaphor as far as the emotional state that we're going through or we're experiencing, that's where it's very helpful to say there is no gravity when it comes to emotions. There is only flow and law. And there is a law that actually dictates how we can move our potentiality, how we can move from one state to another. And it is through this law that Joseph Campbell talks about what is the difference between somebody who's schizophrenic versus somebody who's actually a shaman. Because a lot of times a shaman has to take, an enlightened shaman or medicine man or what have you, medicine woman, has to take a very similar journey psychologically and emotionally that the schizophrenic takes. The difference is the schizophrenic gets lost in space, whereas the shaman or medicine man or sacred clown actually has to reintegrate into society. And therein lies the difference. But the path is almost identical, which is why when someone is waking up to their true positive potential, they can be a little crazy at times or seem crazy to those who know them.
Right. And you know, when I think of you know, like that experience of a shaman, and others who go into that other realm, that it, to describe it literally to someone who is very grounded in earth and doesn't move there, I find it very difficult, if not impossible, because it's almost to me like a feeling, a sense of, you know, I was there. And so if I'm describing to you an experience I have had, you don't necessarily have to get all the details and everything, but immediately it may connect with some experience you already had.
One of the beautiful things I enjoy is meeting shamans, no matter what their faith or culture, because they're throughout the world. And I never have difficulty communicating with them, because you can go into physics and speak very quickly. such as they have metaphors, they have language that they use to communicate with other shamans of their particular tribe or culture. But when I start bringing in physics, then we can all talk in the same way. So when we talk about the other realm, realize it's just a way of movement. It's the fourth dimension. So most people like to mix dimensional space. So just real quick, allow me to be a science teacher just for a moment. And that is, when you talk about three-dimensional space, it's how many pieces of data do you need to meet me in that location? That is dimensional space. So when you hear somebody like Janine Boland talking about dimensional space, what I am sharing with you is, how many pieces of information do you need to meet me there? Now, when it comes to shamanism, I would meet other shamans in the fourth dimension, but I had to give them yet another piece of information before they could see me there or meet me there. And we had to use our cultural reference frames. We had to use a lot of differences because I had a spiritual experience where I was meeting three different shamans. Two were Native American from very different tribes. One was a Puebloan. The other one was very much a Plains Native American. And then I was also working with one who was Peruvian, who totally had none of the metaphors that the other two. And then you have me, Irish Catholic. Oh my gosh, you know, talk about insanity as far as cultural differences. However, the piece of information I gave them was, and I told them this very specific piece of information, they knew exactly where to meet me. So what we talk about in physics for that is, anytime people start talking about dimensions, and this is where my trigger point is, this is where I get very passionate, is when people start talking about 11th dimensions and 12 dimensions, I go, how many pieces of information do I need to get to where you are? To which they're like, I don't have any words. I'm like, then you're not talking dimension anymore. Dimensions are pieces of information needed so I can meet you there, whether it's my soul, whether it's my super consciousness, whether it's my subconscious. That's what dimensionality is. So don't get too worked up when you hear people talk about, well, the people I'm talking to or the spirit that I'm talking to is a fifth dimensional being. I'm like, what, the fourth dimensional beings weren't busy enough for you? You had to go to the fifth dimension? That's me teasing. I'm poking fun. I'm not busting right on anybody's perception. It's just as a physicist and as a scientist, the word dimensionality can lead you astray if you don't know exactly what the other person is talking about. So for me, now you know.
Oh, that's fascinating. And I do want to remind our listening audience, this is Jerry Fabianik on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9 here in Clear Creek County, Colorado, up in the studio of the radio, and visiting here with author, shaman, scientist Janine Boland, and really intrigued there. And oh my gosh, I mean, we're really getting in there with dimensions and so on. But I want to back up just a little bit there. You know, in a second, I'm going to ask you, because when people think of shaman, stereotypes come into play. Okay, so I'm going to ask you to clarify what a shaman is. You already differentiated and said that a shaman, perhaps the Sioux here in North America, might not have the the same basis of information that one might in Peru. And then you come in from an Irish Catholic family, you come in with another set. And I just finished watching again Joseph Campbell's, my one guru in life, I call him, The Power of Myth. And I'm trying to think of the German man's name from the 19th century, but he's the one who came up with the idea of the folk ideas and elementary ideas. And that's where Carl Jung eventually came up with his principle of archetypes. And how Campbell differentiates between them is that there's the archetype out there, so the shaman itself. So I'm going to ask you to talk about that. But then in its local form and representation, it is different because of the locality and cultural experiences that we've had.
So, okay, well, I'll do my best, and then you guide me where you want me to go on some of this stuff.
I jumped all over, didn't I?
You did, jumped a little far for me, but that's okay. I'm quantum. We can do this. Mm-hmm. So the thing is this. When it comes to shamanism, each culture is going to have their own shaman. What a shaman does is somebody who is an expert at moving back and forth between three-dimensional space and four-dimensional space. That is my personal definition because of the number of different shamans I have had the privilege and the honor to talk to and learn from. When I studied a lot about Joseph Campbell because I needed to learn archetypes. I've studied a lot about Jung because I needed the archetype, because no matter what culture I was in, no matter what country I was standing in, I knew there was a shaman there that would be able to connect with me and we would be able to heal, so-called heal, something that was wrong with three-dimensional space-time for an individual who was either suffering from cancer or tribal land that was sick and needed healing. We were going to have to morph the matter of three-dimensional vibration in some way. To do that, a shaman moves back and forth between three and fourth dimensions. So that is how I define a shaman. What is the difference between a shaman and a medicine man or a medicine woman? The medicine man or medicine woman is what we would call a doctor, a physician. They are dealing with the physical body. Many times they'll also deal with the emotional body. Well, here in America, we have psychiatrists, which are medical doctors who also deal with the emotional side. So that's kind of what you can define in that way. They use herbs for healing. They're talking to the person about what is your environment like and that sort of thing. There's a little bit of blurring for shamanism versus medicine man, medicine woman, now that people have become so much more aware, including tribal people who have always been, always had the elements of this. But there's a little bit of blurring of those lines because of the age we are currently residing in, so that there's a little bit of movement back and forth. Then you have the shaman who comes in, and I like to call the shaman more of a emotional, spiritual healer who can actually manifest a physical change without the tools of an herb. But sometimes you'll see shamans use an herb. So that's where it gets a little wonky when you start moving between one tribe or another regarding that sort of aspect.
Well, and that makes sense in this sense, that in our Western culture, we traditionally we have, you mentioned like psychotherapists and so on, but you also have priests and ministers and rabbis who also counsel individuals. Okay, now the psychotherapist, psychologist focuses on the mind itself without any of the religious trappings, whereas like with the rabbi and the other ministers of faith are focusing more on the spiritual, but nonetheless it still comes back to, and it loops back to quantum, where there's no separation, is there?
One of my favorite topics was when I was talking about physics, I'd always say to everyone, look, we're going to go far and wide on this topic because in my mind, as a teacher, it's all the same topic. Why? Because I enjoy physics. I'm a scientist. It's all the same. No matter whether I'm looking at it through the lens of spirituality or if I'm looking at it through the lens of mathematics, to me, it's all the same topic. It's, are you happy? Are you enjoying your manifested life? If the answer is no, then let's find a person or individual who you can work with to create the vibration, to create the field of electromagnetism that will define and morph and change the material three-dimensional space around you so that you can be in harmony at a higher level than what you are currently. That is, to me, what disease is. Now, you start talking like that to someone who is very physically grounded, who believes this is a one-or-done relationship here. I live, I die, I go to heaven. There's a lot of people that still run around this planet very earthbound saying it's a one or done. I have one life, I'm done, I go to heaven. For those individuals, you need to have physical medicine and psychotherapists because they are that grounded. That is, and they're happy here. And we need to let them live their life in whatever way that looks. But for the individual who has that nagging thought, they have thoughts like, can this be it? Is this all there is? And the answer is no, honey. Do you want to go up to the next level? Time to level up. Like they say, if you haven't driven a warthog upside down, you haven't haloed. And that's for our gamers out there.
Oh, I love that. Other is, in a way, I don't want to be repetitive here, but this other thought is, you in your training, you said you train with Hindu yoga for 20 years. And then you get initiated by the Thunder Clan as a Heyoka. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're also the scientist. So we've been talking about the divergence, if you will, but the convergence of science and spiritual paths and so forth. But going back into that local field again, you know, that your training in the Hindu tradition served you very well, apparently, in the Native American tradition.
It really did, because my father was in the military, which is why I traveled around so much. So my elementary school years, I was in the foothills of Japan in a place called Sasebo. And in Sasebo, there was a temple that I would go to after school. So I'd go to school, have milk and cookies with my mom, and I'd run up to where the Buddhist monks were, because they were a wonderful group of men that I absolutely loved and adored. And they always treated me like one of their daughters. So it was a wonderful time. They taught me the basic of meditation, but I didn't understand it. You know, you're young. I was 6 years old. I didn't get on with but if I was really patient and sat very still, I got to have those beautiful honey cookies that they only made with rice. It was wonderful. So, of course, it was all about the honey cookies. I was very much like Kung Fu Panda with that. But it was all about the cookie, right? The almond cookies.
How old were you then?
I was six, so that's right.
Well, that makes total sense.
All about the cookie.
I'd still be at my age and, you know, with the honey cookies.
Precisely so. So my middle school years, we were in the Bahamas, and there I was trained by the Irish Catholic priests that were on the island, but also by the Voodoo Obadiah priestesses from Haiti. And so I got a very different perspective. Voodoo is nothing like what I see when I'm in America watching Hollywood films. I'm like, I don't know who these people are.
Yeah.
So one of the fun things that I like to share with people regarding the Hindu training is that it had the same discipline as the military. It's all about discipline. Discipline of the mind, discipline of your emotions, discipline of your physicality. If you do not have discipline, then you might as well be an animal. And that is frequently where a lot of us find ourselves, is, am I going to be an animal or am I truly going to be a human? And I think Frank Herbert in Dune really brought this message home very beautifully in his works.
Yeah. So, all right. And we're going to take a quick break here. So this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. And this is Writer's Talk, visiting here with Janine Bolin and her works. And we will be right back now. All right. Hey, everyone. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. And visiting here on the Rabbit Hole, Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole with Janine Bolin, who's the author of Seeking the Divine, Finding the Divine, and you're in the process of writing.
Expressing the Divine. Yeah, that's the third one in the series.
All right. And other works as well. And when we left off, Janine, you were talking about your experience as a little girl in Japan with the Buddhist monks, and immediately two traditions jump into mind for me. Zen Buddhism, which is different than Tibetan Buddhism. You know, it might be the difference, I don't know, between Presbyterians and Methodists. I don't know. I mean, they're Buddhist, but there's different practices and emphasis. And then also Shintoism, because Shintoism, to me, is not a religion per se, you know, as we think about it, but has a more natural element to it. So if you could talk about those.
Well, I would love to be able to talk about those, but because I was so young, I have a seven-year-old's perspective, okay?
Oh, that
so
might be even better.
Please realize I wasn't in country long enough, and it wasn't my path. So when it came to Zen Buddhism and the art of being able to empty, to become a vessel. So a lot of people say, oh, you're supposed to empty your mind. That's not quite true, but that is what Americans, or I say Americans, but that's what I see a lot of American people go to. Whereas the Shinto faith, that was more in line with the people that I was exposed to when I was in Japan. And that is more, everything has a soul. And then we go back to physics. Sorry, I'm going to have to pull it back there. Because it wasn't until I was in college that I went, oh my gosh, they've tapped into something. They totally know that everything has a soul, was the word I was used. But what we say now is vibration. Everything has a vibration. And if you want to alter your experience or your surroundings, the Shinto say, alter the vibration. And in order to do that, you have to change yourself first. You have to change yourself to the area you want to be. And sometimes you may be asking something to change that is not in its natural law or its natural state. So that's where Shintao comes in. I wish I could speak more to Zen, but Zen is more about being a vessel and moving to that place of total and complete, to use modern terms, now, to be so present in the now that you're an empty vessel for anything that might come in. And some people send a lot of warnings regarding that and the dangers of it, and I have found those to be unfounded. That's more up to individual practice. So that's about all I can say on those two subjects, but I'm willing to talk about anything else.
No problem there whatsoever, because it is, for all of us, this is a continual lifelong learning experience. And I just recommend watching, if you haven't seen it yet, and if you have, rewatch it, Joseph Campbell's Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. It's now over 30 years old, but it is still so timely there. And as Moyers points out, he has this encyclopedic memory and knowledge of culture and stories. You know, Bill Moyers was asking a question. The next thing you know, his eyes go up to the left, and then he starts, he goes, oh, and there's a story in Native American or in this area in East Africa, and they talk, and he's a delightful storyteller. Next thing you know, you're hooked. You want to hear the story itself, and his whole point, I think, for me, is that Campbell studied cultures all over the world, and he came back to, we're all trying to figure out the same stuff: why are we here? How did we get here? What's going to happen when we die? And we tell it through stories. And he calls it mythologies. Mm-hmm. And so whether the mythology is Shintoism in Japan or shamanism or whatever we might describe here in North America or in Peru, Catholicism in Europe or something of this name, Islam, we're all still, because none of us knows. None of us has any proof that what we believe in is true.
Mm-hmm. So this is one of the most beautiful things is when people start asking what I say is the right question, not meaning that people are wrong, but when they start asking the right questions for themselves, which is, why am I here? That's a right question. What is it that I am going to do with myself? What makes me happy? It's very narcissistic, according to our culture, according to everything I was taught as an Irish Catholic. This is very narcissistic behavior, is what I've been taught. Well, guess what? As children, we're pretty narcissistic. Mm-hmm. We cry when we're hungry. We get fed. You know, we learn very quickly that it really is all about me. The thing is many of us have a calling. Many of us came here on this planet to serve the greater good. And it's very foggy. We don't know what that really means. And then there are a few crazy people running around this planet that go, I got my answer. I can help you learn yours. But anytime you have a teacher that says, I know what's best for you, run screaming in the opposite direction. What I would encourage you to do is make sure that when you are asking your right questions, which are the narcissistic ones, which are the selfish ones, as we're taught, that when you're asking those questions, that you find teachers, and there's a lot of them out there, you find the right teacher that you harmonize with. They make you realize things you didn't know about yourself before, and you learn from them as much as you can. But at any time when they try to control you by saying, this is what you need to think, this is what you need to feel, and this is how you need to behave, those three areas are the areas as a shaman where I'm kept very busy, because I'm having to heal people of those incorrect paradigms for them. It's not saying that it was wrong for other people, but for you personally, much of the disease that I see as an emotional and spiritual healer is from those three areas of control.
And well, you hit right on it there with control. And one thing that Campbell points out, that the fundamental difference between the Western traditions compared to the Eastern traditions, in which in the West, the individual is everything, whereas in the Eastern traditions, the individual gets submerged to the societal, and therefore you have a role to play, and there you are, and you don't question. Whereas in our tradition, which is marvelous, because we don't know the answer. So we do fall into that, I'll call it a trap, where I'm not sure what the answer is, and I don't have time, or I'm scared to, too afraid to explore it myself. So therefore, I'm just going to subscribe. And I point out that religion, for most people, my point of view here, is actually an accident of birth. Mm-hmm. Why is the reason you are raised in the, or had believed, maybe you still do, in the Irish Catholic tradition?
Right. Yes, that was one of the interesting aspects of my life is whatever you happen to be born into, you start to question. Most people start questioning about the time they're 12 or 13, about the time puberty hits, you're wanting to answer those questions for yourself. You are starting to expand. You're starting to grow in neat and novel ways. And so I get a lot of people coming to me, young people at that time saying, you seem to have these answers. How did you figure it out? And I'm like, guess what, Sparky? My way is definitely not your way. And that's where we'll go back down to the rabbit hole because I love that. Alice in Wonderland, the Queen of Hearts, man, she is rocking awesome because it's there is no way. There's only my way, says the ego, right? And we're taught to avoid that in a lot of our paradigms. But the thing is this is where she is correct. There is no right way for you, but your way. So the Queen of Hearts is actually trying to teach us that you need to follow your way. So go to teachers, learn from them, expand your mind, expand your awareness, but be aware of anybody who tells you how to think, how to feel, or how to behave.
Right. And as a teacher, I used to teach English and social studies, and I would constantly challenge my students. Whatever the point of view that was being generally held, I would like to take the opposite there. My goal was not to tell them what my interpretation of Ahab and Moby Dick was the correct one. He's a very complex character. Daisy in The Great Gatsby is a very complex character. And for us to look at people in this box and look at life in a box, I think does a disservice to our own selves. And this is where I think we do start bordering on mental dis-ease, as you point out, psychological dis-ease, uncomfortable with the changes around us, because change is inevitable. It is going to happen, whether you like it or not. So how do we make sense of it in this particular day and age?
Mm-hmm. One of the beautiful ways is that everybody is going to make sense of it in their own way. So one of the things I always like to throw out to my physics students was that we are bordering on 8 billion people on this planet. And understanding life the way I understand it means there are 8 billion realities operating at once. And some people, that blows their mind. They can't even begin to get there. And I'm like, you have to remember, each one of us is an avatar running around on this planet, soaking up experiences, seeing things that no one else is seeing, hearing things. This is where, if you want to take it in the divine, God cherishes every single one of us. Now, some of us don't like me using the word God because God denotes a certain type of figure in their brain. So let's say this, source. I like the word source because source emanates light. Even in physics, source, we call them source points, where we see these places that are just emitting nothing but light, and they're not suns. So one of the neat things that I like to share with people is, all right, let's talk about source, the source of all that is. So if you don't, we're running around on this planet, three-dimensional planet, and source operates at a dimensionality that is beyond our comprehension. So if we know this about ourselves and we're running around on this three-dimensional planet, the thing that source receives from us is all of our experiences, all of our perspectives, and there is no way that you would say one person is more valuable than another. That is an impossibility if you're operating from the I or from the understanding of source, because source needs every single person on this planet operating exactly the way they are, so that all the perspectives, all the potentiality can not only be expressed, but expanded upon. It's we humans that define whether something is good or bad. And I'm in agreement with that, especially if somebody does something that causes another person to die because they haven't had a chance to express their full potentiality yet. Now we can get into reincarnation and we can talk about karma and all that kind of thing. But I have found those are yet more tools of control. When I really dug into the seriousness of karma. What was karma originally raised for? It was to answer the question of the caste system and why certain people were born into lower understandings than others. And so there we go. We can go a little deeper into that, but I like to hang out in the physics space because it's a lot more fun there, and you don't get wrapped up in what's right or wrong. You just get it wrapped up into potential and perspective.
I love it. That is so amazing. Yeah, how you describe that there, and then bring it back to quantum with the potential, and how we each do. Some people, God implies a whole lot of stuff. It's culturally laden, and even the people who say God and God, whether it's Western or Christian or Judaism or Islam, which are the big three that center around the concept of God, each one's going to have a different perception of what that entity or that source or that energy is. My end, I call it the universe, okay? And maybe I'm maybe off on this, you can correct me, but Carl Jung called it the great unconscious, the collective unconscious. You know, so where is that? That there's something more. Bottom line is there's something more to life. And even if you believe in a traditional religion, You're subscribing to that. There's something beyond, but rather than it being defined for you, then what we're talking about here is you got to go out there and find it out for yourself, because you know that's what life is about. Campbell says, life has no purpose or meaning. You have it. You give it meaning in what you think it should be.
And that's where I agree with them. So we'll go back to my book with the Finding the Divine. One of the reasons that I wrote that book was because of the number of people that I would help or assist, and my students were demanding that I reach out and start expressing what I knew in book form. They wanted words because they would have experiences meditating with me, and then they would have experiences meditating on their own, and they're like, something is drastically different. The difference is I know what source is. I've had experiences where my soul has totally gone back to source and merged with that. Now, I'm not the only one that has had this type of experience. There are other people on this planet currently who are alive, incarnate, that are what we call awakened or enlightened. But the problem is once you've had that experience, all you can do is share how you got there. All you can do is share what you can put into words. You are limited by your culture. You're limited by your definitions. You're limited by the physical language that we use. There are so many limitations on trying to bring what is a multidimensional experience back into a small, tiny, relevant, three-dimensional space. And so in the book, I talk about I never wanted to express all this. All I ever wanted was a two-way conversation with God, because at the time that I was seeking God, that's what I knew. And I wanted a two-way conversation because I was jealous, and I'll admit to that. Why did Moses get to talk to him? Why did Jonah get to talk to him? There were all these guys. And I was really frustrated as a little 12-year-old Catholic girl sitting there with my rosary talking to Mom, Mother Mary, going, what's up? What is up with all this, right? I'm a woman. I had a role. I knew I had a role in this society, but my role was pretty limited. I could be a martyr. I could die for God to try to find a way to communicate with him. I wasn't too fond of that one. Then there was, I could be a mother and a wife and really relish that role. But, you know, mothers and wives really didn't get a lot of good press when it came to what we know as Catholicism. So then I could stay a virgin and get into a convent. Wasn't really pressed with that because I didn't see how I could help my fellow man more than that. And I use man as that era. But so I was kind of stuck, and I knew there was something more. So I was like, you know what? My mom always told me, if I wanted to learn the truth about something, go talk to the person or read the book that person wrote. So go to original source documents. Fine. I was going to do that. And I want to say, oh, I was a very devout Catholic and I did it that way. No, I was a pissed off chick who wanted nothing but to talk to her dad. And in my book, I call God Daddy. And that really has caused me a lot of problems. People were very unhappy with that book, with that. I was actually told to change that part of it. I was like, no, that is how I got there. So I went, all right, dad. You're the king of the freaking cosmos. By the way, this is the G rating. I did not pray this way. I prayed to God in all of the raw military forms you hear sailors use and said, you get your scrawny little butt down here on planet Earth and you come help me because nobody else seems to know who or what you are, and I'm done with this. I am done with learning it from everybody else. And so that's what I said for 25 plus years. And then in my book, Finding the Divine, I actually relate the series of events that happened to me that was God revealing himself and all of his understanding to me. Now, one of the things I wanted to share, because I am in this life born a female, I will see the divine in masculine terms, almost like a harmonization of energetic influences. With the men that I have met that are enlightened and who have had the enlightening experience, it happened to them in the feminine version. And so that was something I found very interesting. And I've met probably about 22 different people who are enlightened. And so we talk about those experiences, and it may have happened very uniquely for each of us, but all of us came back with the same understanding of our life purpose.
Yeah, and one way to throw people off, you know, are when someone sneezes, oftentimes, what does one say?
God bless you.
And then my response oftentimes is, she has. And it just throws them because I've taken completely out of the gender. And Campbell, we don't need to go into that because we're going to be running out of time there, but just an FYI for our audience, in his series there, Power of Myth, he talks about how the religions eventually evolved and how back in the agricultural age, it was the divine feminine there because it was birth. It was, you know, the corn coming out of the ground sort of stuff there. And so it was the feminine that had the power. But then as the herding company culture starts to invade, and then we get more of the masculine because it's the hunting, it's the control and everything. And there's a wonderful work out, and I'm going to get it, I think Daniel Quinn wrote it, Ishmael. And which he uses the metaphor of Cain and Abel. Cain was the farmer. Abel was the sheep herder. He was the shepherd. And so Cain was trying to resist, and that's why. Now, it's a wonderful metaphor in a way to read it that way, to take that there. But I want to shift over before we run out of time here, because one of the questions I have for you, Janine, is about cultural appropriation. And it is something I have heard, you know, because I'm one who doesn't go on the traditional path. And do I have a right to go to, for example, like Chaco Canyon or something like this, or into another Zen Buddhist, you know, whatever? Why can't I just stay in my own? How do you address that yourself?
Well, cultural appropriation is something that has come up a lot because of the fact that I use the term that I'm a shaman, and I have had Native Americans come up to me and say, you have no right to use that. That's our word. To which I go, I'm sorry, they use it in 23 different countries, the term shaman. It is a tribal word. Now, in North America, you have all rights to it, of course, because you are tribal. And I will be the first one to admit, my people are Irish, okay? I know exactly where my people came from. But at the same time, when it comes to cultural appropriation, when I have been accused of this is because I was teaching a medicine wheel and I was teaching how to walk a wheel. And people, I had one Native American chief, never the shamans. By the way, the mystics of each culture acknowledge me and immediately agree, or we are in a simpatico. There is no difficulty. It's only leaders of tribes. It's only tribal members that have issues. The mystics of each tribe, I can sniff them out so fast. They sniff me out. They're like, hello, what have you come to teach me? And I'm like, I have come to learn from you. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an understanding of peers there. We see each other as humans on planet Earth. We do not see ourselves as anything beyond that. So with cultural appropriation, it is where people will accuse you of that. And I always find it that it's people in control, people in positions of authority, and people who have not had the experiences I have had. So the best way to not allow the release of that control is to say, I'm appropriating their culture and I'm not worthy, you know, to be around. I have been kicked out of over 17 different sacred ceremonies because of that word, a cultural appropriation. Because my skin is white, and because they don't feel that I have gone through the appropriate needs or what have you. And I want to reach out to all those Native Americans out there who have been kicked out of their very own tribes because they know something, they are experiencing something, and they are moving beyond the limitations of their tribe. I just want to let you know that you are in company. There are a lot of us that have moved beyond. Please realize I got kicked out of Catholicism because I was having visions and I couldn't say without a shadow of a doubt whether they were angels or whether they were demons, because they weren't presenting as either. They were presenting as Native American warriors, and I had no idea who these things were, these people were that were talking to me. And so the priest told me I had to do so many Hail Marys and that I was a witch if I didn't give up these visions, like I had a choice, right? Mm-hmm. So cultural appropriation, realize when you hear that, who is it that's speaking? And what is that person's level of authority? And is that person a mystic? And then answer those questions and you'll know who you need to listen to and you'll know who may be more truth-speaking.
Wow. I mean, you're getting right at it there. And then you think of, like, and you said you got kicked out of Catholicism. And really what it comes down to, whether it's tribal, cultural, or religion, it's still a limitation. It's a group of people get together. And anytime you have a group, you always have the alpha ones in there, right, who want to control and keep it pure in some way. And so it cannot tolerate any type of heresy or deviance from that. And, but when you mention about the mystics, right away, they recognize, they see it. You see people who are just there. You just share that energy. And that really comes back to Jungian concept also, the archetype. And that the archetype of the shaman, all archetypes are universal. It's only where they get narrowed into the cultural expression of them that we get down. So what is a hero? That's an archetype right there. What is the difference between a warrior and a soldier? Those are archetypes. Mother, being a mother in India is different than perhaps being a mother in America. Okay, but motherhood, all women know who have had babies know what motherhood is all about. And same for men who have helped procreate them there. But we define them within our own cultures and so forth too. And there's one other concept before we wrap up I do want to ask you about, because we mentioned right at the beginning, and you mentioned the term a couple of times there, Hayoka, the sacred clown. And I'm going, like, I love this here. Talk about that, Ginny.
Okay, well, first of all, what is a sacred clown? Okay, for the people of the Lakota tribe, I want to expressly chat with you for just a minute. I was called Hayoka in vision. I had no idea what the term was. I was running around trying to say, I have a man who is a skeleton who is on fire, and he's speaking to me and he terrifies me. I have no idea who this thing is. He's not a demon. He's not God. He doesn't fit into any paradigms that I had currently in my life. And he keeps saying, I'm Hayoka. And I don't know what that means. So I sought out Native Americans, desperately trying to figure out what this vision was that I was having. I found a Lakota Native American, and he was able to help me. And it was through that group that I was able to be initiated according to the tradition. They asked me a bunch of questions. Have you ever been struck by lightning? Have you ever had control over life or death? Have you ever taken a life? All of these sorts of things were asked of me. And when I answered these specific questions and more, it was determined that I needed to be initiated into the Thunder Clan. So I am one of the Wakians chosen. I have been ever since the age of 8, but I had no idea what was going on. So when people accuse me of cultural appropriation, I want to start cussing like a sailor at that point and go, I was picked. I was just minding my own business and I got struck. I was not seeking out to be anything. Hello. And that's pretty much what Campbell talks about, right? Is the reluctant hero is like, whoa, back up the truck. This is not it. So you asked about what is a sacred clown. Let me get to that. A sacred clown, for a Westerner, I like to go back to the times of the medieval era and the feudal era. When you had a king, you had what we called the fool or the clown or the jester. what was the purpose of the fool? I want to speak specifically to the fool because that was a very specific job title. The fool was to give the king two things, or any man, or any person of royalty that had a fool. Usually it was the king's or queen's. The fool's job was to give the king or queen's perspective and to give the king or queen an opportunity to lighten up. So they were seen as entertainers, but they had a very specific purpose to their entertainment. It was to give the king or queen an alternative perspective. It was also to keep royalty grounded in reality because you were surrounded by sycophants and politics and all kinds of things that were not in your better judgment. They really didn't care whether you lived or died, some of them, just as long as you gave them their plot of land. So the fool could go and see a lot of things because they were seen as being insane. They weren't quite right in the head, right? So they were the only ones that were allowed to sit in the presence of the king. They were the only ones that were allowed to tease the king, the only ones allowed to tease royalty. They were given a pass. They were outside of what we call the tribal circle. They were outside of court, but yet very much intimately aware of the court. So in most of Shakespeare's writings, there's always a fool. Mm-hmm. And I can spot the fool immediately because he's the one joking and jesting and saying what's really happening when everybody else is trying to cover it up.
Yeah.
They can spot it. So for several of the tribes that I have had the honor of being able to walk into, I always say, I'm a fool. I don't call myself Heoka. I don't call myself a clown. I say, I am the fool, to let them know I acknowledge the difference that I bring to this tribal whatever. And so, but the sacred clown, let's talk about tribal moment. The sacred clown is supposed to operate outside of tribal culture. They do what they say is contrary. They usually wear black and white because their job is to keep people from thinking that way. You're not supposed to think in terms of black and white. You're supposed to think in terms of kind of gray area, because if you start thinking in terms of black and white, you're concrete. You're no longer growing. You're not expanding. You're not bringing anything new to the tribe. This could be devastating at any time. Now, one tribe that I was a part of told me that is not the job of the sacred clown. The sacred clown is supposed to come into the tribe and they call people out. So I went, oh, the fool would do that in court. It was up to the king, it was up to the court to decide what to do with an individual. But if somebody was trying to threaten the king, if somebody was trying to threaten royalty, somebody just stirring trouble up, Prince John comes to mind when you think about Much to Do About Nothing. Prince John was somebody that the fool was frequently calling out. But you would call that person out, and then it was up to the rest of people to bring judgment and to bring punishment. But the clown called it out, which is why certain tribes won't even look at clowns. Like, I would have people walk by and cover their eyes, and I was like, what's going on? Because I didn't know what was going on. And they would say, if they look in your eyes, they think they'll die. Mm-hmm. And for what I understood that to mean was they would know who they truly were. Right? Because clowns, many of those sacred clowns, the Heoka that I ran into, were enlightened. Like, they knew that being a human on planet Earth was vacation. Mm-hmm. That being a human on planet Earth, there was something else going on. And to look in the eyes of a clown, people were afraid they would learn exactly what they were.
Oh, man, and that's always a scary thought for folks here. So we're out of time here, but before we go, people want to get a hold of you, your website. Talk about that.
My website is the8gates.com. So you have the word the, T-H-E, the number 8, and then gates. And that's very significant for the medicine wheel. So the8gates.com, and there you can get a hold of me.
All right. And just to remind our audience, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM, 102.7, 103.9. And this has been Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole. We've been talking about the rabbit hole quite a bit, right? And visiting here with Janine Bolan, and author of Finding the Divine, Searching for the Divine, and then soon to come,
Expressing the Divine,
and numerous other works as well. So go to her website and you will learn more. Okay, we'll be back at another time now. So everyone be safe, be kind, and keep your mind open. Okay, bye now.